wandered away, or no one has taken care of her, which seems more likely from the state of her clothes, and she wandered in here when the curators weren't looking.
It may be somebody's cracked her over the head, took her things, and threw her in here, thinking she was gone. There's more ways in, Mistress Slops, than the curator knows of. Or maybe somebody brought her in to be sunk when she was only sick and sleeping. In a coma, as they call it, and the water woke her up.
Surely whoever brought her in would have seen her.
They can stay under a long time in a coma, so I've heard. But whichever way it was, it don't much matter now. Here she is, and it's up to her, I should say, to find out where she come from and who she is.
I had dropped the brown mantle and was trying to wring my guild cloak dry, but I looked up when Agia said, "You've been asking all of us who we are. Who are you?"
"You've every right to know," the big man said. "Every right in the world. And I'll give you better bona fides than any of you have given me. Only after I does so, I must be about my own business. I come because I saw the young armiger here drowning, like any good man would. But I've my own affairs to take care of, the same as the next."
With that, he pulled off his tall hat, and reaching inside, produced a greasy card about twice the size of the calling cards I had occasionally seen in the Citadel. He handed it to Agia, and I peered over her shoulder. In florid script, the legend read, "Hildegrin the Badger. Excavations of all kinds by a single digger or 20 score. Stone is not too hard nor mud too soft. Ask on Argosy Street at the sign of the Blind Shovel, or inquire at the Alta Camillus around the corner on Valiety."
"And that's who I am, Mistress Slops and young sir, which I hope you won't mind my calling you, firstly because you're younger nor me, and secondly because you're a sight younger than what she is, for all you was probably born only a couple years sooner. And I'll be on my way."
I stopped him. Before I fell in, I met an old man in a skiff who told me there was someone farther down the track who could ferry us across the lake. I think you must be the man he referred to. Will you take us?
"Ah, the one what's looking for his wife, poor soul. Well, he's been a good friend to me many a time, so if he recommends you, I suppose I'd better do it. My scowl will hold 4 in a pinch."
He strode off, motioning for us to follow. I noticed that his boots, which seemed to have been greased, sank in the sedge even deeper than my own. Agia said, "She's not coming with us." Still, it was obvious that she, Dorcas, was, trailing along beside Agia and looking so forlorn that I dropped behind to try to comfort her. "I'd lend you my mantle," I whispered to her. "If it weren't so wet, it would make you cooler than you are already. But if you'll go along this track the other way, you'll come out of here altogether and into a corridor where it's warmer and drier. Then if you'll look for a door with jungle garden on it, that will let you into a place where the sun is warm and you'll be quite comfortable." I had no sooner spoken than I remembered the pelicosaur we had seen in the jungle. Fortunately, perhaps, Dorcas showed no sign of having heard what I said. Something in her face conveyed that she was afraid of Agia, or at least aware, in a helpless way, of having displeased her. But there was no other indication she was any more alert to her surroundings than a somnambulist. Conscious that I had failed to relieve her misery, I began again. "There's a man in the corridor, a curator. I'm sure he'll at least try to find some clothes and a fire for you." The wind whipped Agia's chestnut hair as she looked back at us. "There are too many of these beggar girls for anyone to be worried about one, Severian, including yourself." At the sound of Agia's voice, Hildegrin glanced over his shoulder.
I know a woman might take her in.
Yes, and clean her up and give her some clothes. There's a high-bred shape under that mud, thin though she is.
What are you doing here anyway? Agia snapped. You contract laborers according to your card, but what's your business here?
Just what you said, mistress. My business.
Dorcas had begun to shiver. Honestly, I told her, all you have to do is go back. It's much warmer in the corridor. Don't go in the jungle garden. You might go into the sand garden. It's sunny and dry in there. Something in what I had said seemed to touch a chord in her.
Yes, she whispered. Yes.
The sand garden, you'd like that? Very softly.
Sun.
Here's the old scow now,
Hildegren announced.
With so many, we're going to have to be particular about the Sedan. And there's to be no moving about. She'll be low in the water. One of the women in the bow, please, and the other and the young armiger in the stern.
I said, I'd be happy to take an oar.
Ever rowed before? I thought not. No, you'd best sit in the stern like I told you. It ain't much harder pulling two oars than one, and I've done it many a time, believe me, though there was half a dozen in her with me.
His boat was like himself, wide, rough, and heavy-looking. Bow and stern were square, so much so that there was hardly any horizontal taper from the waist, where the rowlocks were, though the hull was shallower at the ends. Hildegren got in first, and, standing with one leg to either side of the bench, used an oar to nudge the boat closer to shore for us.
You,
Agia said, taking Dorcas by the arm,
you sit up there in front.
Dorcas seemed willing to obey, but Hildegren stopped her.
If you don't mind, mistress,
he said to Agia,
I'd sooner it was you in the bow. I won't be able to keep my eye on her, you see, when I'm rowing, unless she sits behind. She's not right, which even you and me can agree on. And low as we'll be, I'd like to know if she starts frisking around.
Dorcas surprised us all by saying, I'm not mad. It's just, I feel as if I've just been wakened.
Hildegren made her sit in the stern with me nonetheless.
Now this, he said as he pushed us off, this is something you're not likely to forget if you've never done it before. Cross in the Lake of Birds here, in the middle of the Garden of Everlasting Sleep.
His oars dipping into the water made a dull and somehow melancholy sound. I asked why it was called the Lake of Birds.
Because so many's found dead in the water, is what some say. But it might only be that that's because there's so many here. There's a great deal set against death. I mean, by the people that has to die, drawing her picture like a crone with a sack and all that. But she's a good friend to birds, death is. Wherever there's dead men in quiet, you'll find a good many birds. That's been my experience.
Recalling how the thrushes sang in our necropolis, I nodded.
Now, if you'll look past my shoulder, you'll have a clear view of the shore ahead of us and be able to see a lot of things you couldn't before, because of the rushes growing all around you back there. You'll notice, if it's not too misty, that the land rises farther on. The bogginess stops there, and the trees begin. Can you see them?
I nodded again, and beside me, Dorcas nodded as well.
That's because this whole peep show is meant to look like the mouth of a dead volcano. The mouth of a dead man is what some say. But that's not really so. If it was, they'd have put in teeth. You'll remember, though, that when you come in here, you come up through a pipe in the ground.
Once more, Dorcas and I nodded together. Though Agia was no more than 2 strides from us, she was nearly out of sight behind Hildegren's broad shoulders and fear-naught coat.
Over there,
he continued, jerking his square chin to show the direction.
You ought to be able to see a spot of black. Just about halfway up it is, between the bog and the rim. Some Sedan thinks it's where they come out of, but that's behind you and lower down and a whole lot smaller. This that you see now is the cave of the Cumaean, the woman that knows the future and the past and everything else. There's some that say this whole place was built only for her, though I don't believe it.
Softly, Dorcas asked, How could that be?
And Hildegrin misunderstood her, or at least pretended to do so.
The Autarch wants her here, so they say, so he can come and talk without traveling to the other side of the world. I wouldn't know about that, but sometimes I see somebody walking around up there in metal or maybe a jewel or two flashing. Who it is, I wouldn't know, and since I don't want to know my future, and I know my past, I should think, better than her, I don't go near the cave. People come sometimes hoping to know when they'll be married or about success in trade, but I've observed they don't often come back.
We had nearly reached the center of the lake. The Garden of Endless Sleep rose around us like the sides of a vast bowl, mossy with pines toward the lip, scummed with rushes and sedge below. I was still very cold, more so because of the inactivity of sitting in the boat while another rowed. I was beginning to worry about what the immersion in water might do to the blade of Terminus Est if I did not dry and oil it soon. Yet even so, the spell of the place held me. A spell there was surely in this garden. I could almost hear it humming over the water, voices chanting in a language I did not know but understood. I think it held everyone, even Hildegrin, even Agia. For some time, we rowed in silence. I saw geese, alive and content for all I could tell, bobbing a long way off. And once, like something in a dream, the nearly human face of a manatee, looking into my own, through a few spans of brownish water. Chapter 24 The Flower of Dissolution. Beside me, Dorcas plucked a water hyacinth and put it in her hair. Except for the vague spot of white on the bank some distance ahead, it was the first flower I had seen in the Garden of Endless Sleep. I looked for others but saw none. Is it possible the flower came into being only because Dorcas reached for it? In daylight moments, I know as well as the next that such things are impossible, but I am riding by night. And then, when I sat in that boat with the hyacinth less than a cubit from my eyes, I wondered at the dim light and recalled Hildegrin's remark of a moment before. A remark that implied, though quite possibly he did not know it, that the Cirrus's cave, and thus this garden, was on the opposite side of the world. There, as Master Malrubius had taught us long ago, all was reversed. Warmth to the south, cold to the north, light at night, dark by day, snow in summer. The chill I felt would be appropriate then, for it would be summer soon, with sleet riding the wind. The darkness that stood even between my eyes and the blue flowers of the water hyacinth would be appropriate then too, for it would soon be night, with light already in the sky. The Increate maintains all things in order, surely. And the Theologicans say light is his shadow. Must it not be, then, that in darkness order grows ever less? Flowers leaping from nothingness into a girl's fingers, just as by light and spring they leap from mere filthiness into the air. Perhaps when night closes our eyes, there is less order than we believe. Perhaps indeed, it is this lack of order we perceive as darkness, a randomization of the ways of energy, like a sea, the fields of energy, like a farm, that appear to our deluded eyes, set by light in an order of which they themselves are incapable, to to be the real world.
Mist was rising from the water, reminding me first of the swirling motes of straw in the insubstantial cathedral of the Pelerines, then of steam from the soup kettle when Brother Cook carried it into the refectory on a winter afternoon. The witches were said to stir such kettles, but I had never seen one, though their tower stood hardly a chain from ours. I remembered that we rode across the crater of a volcano. Might it not have been the Cumaean's kettle? Earth's fires were long dead, as Master Malrubius had taught us. It was more than possible that they had cooled long before men had risen from the position of the beasts to cumber her face with their cities. But witches, it was said, raised the dead. Might not the Cumaean raise the dead fires to boil her pot? I dipped my fingers into the water. It was as cold as snow. Hildegrin leaned toward me as he rode, then drew away as he pulled his oars.
"Go into your death,"
he said.
"That's what you're thinking. I can see it in your face. To the sanguinary field, and he'll kill you, whoever he is."
"Are you?" Dorcas asked and gripped my hand.
When I did not answer, Hildegrin nodded for me.
"Don't have to, you know. There's them that doesn't follow the rules and yet runs free."
"You're mistaken," I said. "I wasn't thinking about Monomachy or dying either." In my ear, too softly, I think, even for Hildegrin to hear, Dorcas said, "Yes, you were. Your face was full of beauty, of a kind of nobility. When the world is horrible, then thoughts are high, full of grace and greatness."
I looked at her thinking she was mocking me, but she was not.
"The world is filled half with evil and half with good. We can tilt it forward so that more good runs into our minds, or back, so that more runs into this." A movement of her eyes took in all the lake. "But the quantities are the same. We change only their proportion, here or there." I would tilt it as far back as I can, until at last the evil runs out altogether. I said, "It might be the good that would run out, but I am like you. I would bend time backward if I could." Nor do I believe that beautiful thoughts or wise ones are engendered by external troubles. I did not say beautiful thoughts, but thoughts of grace and greatness, though I suppose that is a kind of beauty. Let me show you."
She lifted my hand and, slipping it inside her rags, pressed it to her right breast. I could feel the nipple, as firm as a cherry, and the warmth of the gentle mound beneath it, delicate, feather-soft and alive with racing blood.
"Now," she said, "what are your thoughts? If I have made the external world sweet to you, aren't they less than they were?"
"Where did you learn all this?" I asked. Her face was drained of its wisdom, which condensed in crystal drops at the corners of her eyes. The shore on which the Averns grew was less marshy than the other. It seemed strange, after having walked on buoyant sedge and floated on water for so long, to set foot again on soil that was no worse than soft. We had landed at some distance from the plants, but we were near enough now that they were no longer a mere bank of white, but growths of definite color and shape, whose size could be readily estimated.
I said, "They are not from here, are they? not from our earth. No one replied. I think I must have spoken too softly for any of the others, except perhaps Dorcas to hear. They had a stiffness, a geometrical precision, surely born under some other sun. The color of their leaves was that of a scarab's back, but infused with tints at once deeper and more translucent. It seemed to imply the existence of light somewhere, some inconceivable distance away, of a spectrum that would have withered or perhaps ennobled the world. As we walked nearer, Agia leading the way, I following her with Dorcas behind me and Hildegrin following us, I saw that each leaf was like a dagger blade, stiff and pointed, with edges sharp enough to satisfy even Master Gerlo's. Above these leaves, the half-closed white blossoms we had seen from across the lake seemed creations of pure beauty, virginal fantasies guarded by 100 knives. They were wide and lush, and their petals curled in a way that should have seemed tousled if it had not formed a complex swirling pattern that drew the eye like a spiral limned on a revolving disc. Agia said, "Good form requires that you pick the plant yourself, Severian. But I'll go with you and show you how. The trick is to put your arm under the lowest leaves and snap the stem off the ground." Hildegrin caught her by the shoulder.
"That you won't, mistress,"
he said,
and then to me. "You go forward, since you're of a mind to, young seer. I'll take the females to safety."
I was already several strides past him, but I stopped for an instant when he spoke. Luckily, Dorcas called out, "Be careful," at that moment, and I was able to pretend it was her warning that had halted me. The truth was otherwise. From the time we had met Hildegrin, I had felt certain I had encountered him before, though the shock of recognition that had come so swiftly when I saw Sior Racho again was in this instance long delayed. Now it had come at last, with paralyzing force. As I have said, I remember everything, but often I can find a fact, face, or feeling only after a long search. I suppose that in this case, the problem was that from the moment he had bent over me on the sedge track, I could see him clearly, and previously, I had hardly seen him at all. It was only when he said, "I'll take these females to safety," that my memory closed upon his voice. "The leaves are poisoned," Agia called. "Twisting your mantle tight about your arm will give you some protection, but try not to touch them. And watch out. You are always closer to an Avern than you think." I nodded to show I understood. Whether the Avern is deadly to the life of its own world, I have no way of knowing. It may be that it is not, that it is only dangerous to us by reason of a nature accidentally inimical to our own. Whether that is so or not, the ground between and beneath the plants was covered with short and very fine grass, grass quite different from the coarse growth elsewhere, and this short grass was littered with the curled bodies of bees and dotted with the white bones of birds. When I was no more than a couple of paces from the plants, I stopped, suddenly aware of a problem I had given no thought to previously. The Avern I selected would be my weapon in the contest to come. Yet because I knew nothing as yet of the way it would be fought, I had no means of judging which plant might be best adapted to it. I could have gone back and questioned Agia, but I would have felt absurd examining a woman on such a matter, and in the end I decided to trust my judgment, since she would no doubt send me back for another if my first choice were wholly unsuitable. The Averns varied in height from seedlings of hardly more than a span to old plants of 3 cubits or a little less. These older plants had fewer, though larger, leaves. Those of the smaller ones were narrower, and so closely spaced that the stems were completely hidden. Those of the big plants were much broader in proportion to their length, and somewhat separated on the fleshy-looking stems. If, as seemed likely, the Septentrion and I were to use our plants as maces, the largest possible plant with the longest possible stem and the stoutest possible leaves would be the best. But these all grew well away from the edges of the planting, so that it would be necessary to break down a number of smaller plants to reach them. And to do that by the method Adja had advised was clearly impossible, because the leaves of many of the smaller plants grew nearly to the ground. In the end, I chose one about 2 cubits high. I had knelt beside it and was reaching toward it, when, as though a veil had been snatched away, I realized that my hand, which I had thought still several spans from the needle-like point of the nearest leaf, was about to be impaled. I drew it back hurriedly. The plant seemed almost out of reach. Indeed, I was not certain I could touch its stem even by lying prone. The temptation to use my sword was very great, but I felt it would disgrace me before Adja and Dorcas to do so, and I knew I would have to handle the plant during the combat in any case. I advanced my hand again, cautiously, this time keeping my forearm in contact with the ground, and discovered that though I had to press my shoulder against the grass, as well to prevent my upper arm from being stabbed by the lowest leaves, I could touch the stem quite readily. A point that appeared to be half a cubit from my face trembled with my breath. It was while I was snapping off the stem, no easy task, that I saw the reason only the short, soft grass flourished beneath the Averns. One of the leaves of the plant I was breaking had cut half through a blade of coarse marsh grass, and the entire grass plant, almost an ell across, had begun to wither. Once picked, the plant was an enormous nuisance, as I ought to have anticipated. It would plainly have been impossible to carry it in Hildegrin's boat as it was, without killing one or more of us. So before we re-embarked, I had to climb the slope and cut a sapling. When the twigs had been lopped, Adja and I bound the Avern to one end of its spindly trunk, so that as we made our way through the city later, I appeared to be bearing some grotesque standard. Then Adja explained the use of the plant as a weapon. And I broke a second plant, although she objected, and at even greater risk, I fear, than before, since I was somewhat too confident, and practiced what she had told me. The Avern is not, as I had assumed, merely a viper-toothed mace. Its leaves can be detached by twisting them between the thumb and forefinger in such a way that the hand does not contact the edges or the point. The leaf is then, in effect, a handleless blade, envenomed and razor-sharp, ready to throw. The fighter holds the plant in his left hand by the base of the stem and plucks the lower leaves to throw with his right. Adja cautioned me, however, to keep my own plant out of my opponent's reach, since as the leaves are removed, an area of bare stem appears, and this he might grasp and use to wrest my plant from me. When I flourished the second plant and practiced striking out with it, and picking and throwing the leaves, I found that my own Avern was likely to be almost as great a danger to me as the Septentrion's. If I held it near me, there was a grave risk of pricking my arm or chest with the long lower leaves. And the flower, with its swirling pattern, held my gaze whenever I glanced down to tear off a leaf, and with the dry lust of death sought to draw me to it.
All this seemed unpleasant enough. But when I had learned to keep my eyes away from the half-closed blossom, I reflected that my opponent would be exposed to the same dangers. Throwing the leaves was easier than I had supposed. Their surfaces were glossy, like the leaves of many of the plants I had seen in the jungle garden, so that they left the fingers readily, and they were heavy enough to fly far and true. They could be thrown point foremost like any knife, or made to spin in flight, to cut down anything in their path with their deadly edges. I was eager, of course, to question Hildegrin about Votalus. But no opportunity to do so came until he had rowed us back across the silent lake. Then for a moment, Adya became so intent on driving Dorcas away that I was able to draw him to one side and whisper that I, too, was a friend of Votalus.
"You've mistaken me, young Sierra, for somebody else. Do you refer to Votalus the Outlaw?"
"I never forget a voice," I told him. "Or anything else." And then in my eagerness, I impulsively added what was perhaps the worst thing I could have said. "You tried to brain me with your shovel." His face became mask-like at once, and he stepped back into his boat and rowed out onto the brown water. When Adya and I left the botanic gardens, Dorcas was still with us. Adya was anxious to make her go away, and for a time I permitted her to try. I was moved in part by the fear that with Dorcas near, it would be impossible for me to persuade Adya to lie with me, but even more by a vague appreciation of the pain Dorcas would feel, lost and dismayed as she was already, if she should see me die. Only a short time before, I had poured out to Adya all my sorrow at the death of Thecla. Now these new concerns had replaced it, and I found I had poured it out indeed, as a man might spill sour wine on the ground. By the use of the language of sorrow, I had, for the time being, obliterated my sorrow. So powerful is the charm of words, which for us reduces to manageable entities all the passions that would otherwise madden and destroy us. Whatever my motives may have been, and whatever Adya's may have been, and whatever Dorcas's may have been for following us, nothing Adya did succeeded. And in the end, I threatened to strike her if she did not desist, and called to Dorcas, who was then 50 paces or so behind us. After that, we three trudged along in silence, drawing many strange looks. I was soaked to soddenness, and no longer cared whether my mantle covered my Fulgen torturous cloak. Adya, in her torn brocade, must have looked nearly as strange as I. Dorcas was still smeared with mud. It dried on her in the warm spring wind that now wrapped the city, caking in her golden hair and leaving smears of powdery brown on her pale skin. Above us, the Avern brooded like a gonfalon. From it there drifted a myrrhic perfume. The half-closed flower still shone as white as bone, but its leaves looked nearly black in the sunlight. Chapter 25. The Inn of Lost Loves. It has been my good fortune, or evil fortune as it may be, that the places with which my life has been largely associated have been, with very few exceptions, of the most permanent character. I might tomorrow, if I wished, return to the citadel and, I think, to the very cot on which I slept as an apprentice. Gaiole still rolls past my city of Nessus. The botanic gardens still glitter in the sun, faceted with those strange enclosures, wherein a single mood is preserved for all time. When I think of the ephemera of my life, they are likely to be men and women, but there are a few houses as well. And first among these stands the inn at the margin of the sanguinary field. We had walked away the afternoon, down broad avenues and up narrow byways, and always the buildings that hemmed us round were of stone and brick. At last we came to grounds that seemed no grounds at all, for there was no exalted villa at their center. I remember I warned Agia that a storm was brewing. I could feel the closeness of the air, and I saw a line of bitter black along the horizon. She laughed at me. "What you see and what you feel, too, is nothing more than the city wall. It's always like this here. The wall impedes the movement of the air. That line of dark? It goes halfway to the sky." Agia laughed again, but Dorcas pressed herself against me.
"I am afraid, Severian."
Agia heard her. "Of the wall? It won't hurt you unless it falls on you. And it has stood through a dozen ages." I looked questioningly at her, and she added, "At least it looks that old, and it may be older. Who knows?"
"It could wall out the world."
"Does it stretch completely around the city?"
"By definition, the city is what it has enclosed, though there's open country to the north, so I've heard, and leagues of ruins in the south, where no one lives. But now, look between those poplars. Do you see the inn?"
I did not and said so.
"Under the tree. You've promised me a meal, and that's where I want it. We should just have time to eat before you have to meet the Septentrion."
"Not now," I said. "I'll be happy to feed you when my duel is over. I'll make the arrangements now if you like." I could still find no building, but I had come to see that there was something strange about the tree, a stair of rustic wood twined up the trunk.
"Do so. If you're killed, I'll invite the Septentrion. Or if he won't come, that broken sailor who is forever inviting me. We'll drink to you."
A light kindled high in the branches of the tree, and now I saw that a path led up to the stair. Before it, a painted sign showed a weeping woman dragging a bloody sword. A monstrously fat man in an apron stepped out of the shadow and stood beside it, rubbing his hands while he waited our coming. Faintly now, I could hear the clinking of pots.
"Aben at your command," said the fat man when we reached him. "What is your wish?"
I noticed he kept a nervous eye on my Avern.
"We'll have dinner for two to be served at." I looked at Agia.
"The new watch."
"Good, good, but it cannot be so soon, sir. It will take longer to prepare, unless you'll settle for cold meats, a salad, and a bottle of wine."
Agia looked impatient.
"We'll have a roast fowl. A young one."
"As you wish. I'll have the cook begin his preparations now, and you can amuse yourselves with baked stuff after the sieur's victory until the bird is done."
Agia nodded, and a look flashed between the two that made me feel certain they had met previously.
"Meanwhile," the innkeeper continued, "if you've yet time, I could provide a basin of warm water and a sponge for this other young lady, and perhaps you might all enjoy a glass of Medoc and some biscuits."
I was suddenly conscious of having fasted since my breakfast at dawn with Baldanders and Dr. Talos, and conscious, too, that Agia and Dorcas might have had nothing all day. When I nodded, the innkeeper conducted us up the broad rustic stair. The trunk it circled was a full 10 paces around.
"Have you visited us before, sir?"
I shook my head.
"I was about to ask you what manner of inn this is. I've never seen anything like it."
"Nor will you, sir, except here. But you ought to have come before. We keep a famous kitchen,
and dining in the open air gives one the best appetite.
I thought that it must indeed, if he maintained such a girth, in a place where every room was reached by steps, but I kept the reflection to myself.
The law, you see, sir, forbids all buildings so near the wall. We are permitted, having neither walls nor a roof. Those who attend the sanguinary field come here. The famous combatants and heroes, the spectators and physicians, even the ephors. Here's your chamber now.
It was a circular and perfectly level platform. Around and above it, pale green foliage shut out sight and sound. Adya sat in a canvas chair, and I, very tired, I confess, threw myself down beside Dorcas on a couch made of leather and the linked horns of leechweas and waterbucks. When I had laid the avern behind it, I drew Terminus Est and began to clean her blade. A scullion brought water and a sponge for Dorcas, and when she saw what I was doing, rags and oil for me. I was soon tapping at the pommel so I could strip the blade from its furniture for a real cleaning.
"Can't you wash yourself?" Adya asked Dorcas. "I'd like a bath, yes, but not with you watching me. Severian will turn his head if you ask him.
He did very well in a place where we were this morning."
"And you, madame?" Dorcas said softly. "I'd rather you didn't watch. I'd like a private place, if I might have one."
Adya smiled at that, but I called the scullion again and gave her an aurichok to bring a folding screen. When it was set up, I told Dorcas I would buy her a gown if there were one to be had at the inn.
"No,"
she said. In a whisper, I asked Adya what she thought was the matter with her.
"She likes what she has, clearly.
I must walk with a hand up to hold my bodice if I wouldn't be shamed for life." She let her hand fall so that her high breasts gleamed in the dying sunlight.
"But those rags let her show just leg and chest enough. There's a rent at the groin, too, though I dare say you haven't noticed it."
The innkeeper interrupted us, leading in a waiter who carried a plate of pastries, a bottle, and glasses. I explained that my clothing was wet, and he had a brazier brought in, then proceeded to warm himself by it, for all the world as if he stood in his private apartment.
"Feels good this time of year," he said. "The sun's dead and don't know it yet, but we do. If you're killed, you'll get to miss next winter. And if you're hurt bad, you'll get to stay inside. That's what I always tell them. Of course, most of the fights are around Midsummer's Eve, so it's more appropriate then, so to speak. I don't know if it comforts them or not, but it does no harm."
I took off the brown mantle and my guild cloak, put my boots on a stool near the brazier, and stood beside him to dry my breeches and hose, asking if all those who came this way on Monomachy stopped to refresh themselves with him. Like every man who feels himself likely to die, I would have been happy to know that I was taking part in some established tradition.
Oh, no, he said. "May moderation and Saint Amund bless you, sir. If everyone who came tarried at my inn, why, it wouldn't be my inn. I'd have sold it and be living comfortable in a big stone house with Aatroxes at the door, and a few young fellows with knives hanging about me to settle my enemies. No, there's many a one goes by here without a glance, never thinking that, when he comes past next time, it may be too late to drink my wine."
"Speaking of which," said Adya, and handed me a glass.
It was full to the brim with a dark crimson vintage. Not a good wine, perhaps. It made my tongue prickle, and carried with its delicious taste something of harshness. But a wonderful wine, a wine better than good, in the mouth of someone as fatigued and cold as I. Adya held a full glass of her own, but I saw by her flaming cheeks and sparkling eyes that she had already downed one other at least. I told her to save something for Dorcas, and she said,
"That milk and water, virgin? She won't drink it. And it's you who'll need courage, not she.
Not quite honestly, I said I was not afraid. The innkeeper exclaimed,
That's the way. Don't you be feared, and don't fill your head with no noble thoughts about death and last days and all that. The ones that do is the ones that never come back, you may be sure. Now, you is going to order a meal, I think, for you and your two young women afterward?
We have ordered it, I said.
Ordered but not paid nothing toward, that was my meaning. Also, there's the wine and these here gâteaux sec. Those must be paid for here and now, as they're eaten here and now, and drank up, too. For the dinner, I'll require a deposit of 3 orichalks, with 2 more to be paid when you come to eat it.
And if I don't come?
Then there's no more charge, sir. That's how I'm able to offer my dinners at such low prices.
The man's complete insensibility disarmed me. I handed over the money, and he left us. Agia peeped around the side of the screen behind, which Dorcas was cleansing herself with the aid of the scullion, and I sat down again on the couch and took a pastry to go with what remained of my wine.
If we could make the hinges in this thing lock, Severian, we might enjoy ourselves for a few moments without interruption.
We could put a chair against it, but no doubt those two would choose the worst possible moment to squall and knock everything over. I was about to make some bantering reply when I noticed a scrap of paper, folded many times, that had been put beneath the waiter's tray in such a fashion that it could be seen only by someone sitting where I was.
This is really too much, I said. A challenge and now the mysterious note.
Agia came to look.
What are you talking about? Are you drunk already?
I put my hand on the rounded fullness of her hip, and when she made no objection, used that pleasant handle to draw her toward me until she could see the paper.
What do you suppose it says? The Commonwealth has need of you right at once. Your friend is he who shall say to you, Camarilla, beware of the man with pink hair.
Falling in with the joke, Agia offered,
Come when you hear 3 pebbles tap the window.
The leaves, I should say, here.
The rose hath stabbed the iris, who nectar affords. That's your Verne killing me, clearly. You will know your true love by her red pagne.
She bent to kiss me, then sat in my lap.
Aren't you going to look?
I am looking. Her torn bodice had fallen again.
Not fair. Cover that with your hand, and then you can look at the note.
I did as she told me, but left the note where it was. It's really too much, as I said a moment ago. The mysterious Septentrion and his challenge, then Hildegrin and now this.
Have I mentioned the Chatelaine Thecla to you? More than once, while we were walking. I loved her. She read a great deal. There was really nothing for her to do when I was gone but read and sew and sleep. And when I was with her, we used to laugh at the plots of some of the stories. This sort of thing was always happening to the people in them, and they were incessantly involved in high and melodramatic affairs for which they had no qualifications.
Agia laughed with me and kissed me again, a lingering kiss. When our lips parted, she said,
What's this about Hildegrin?
He seemed ordinary enough. I took another pastry, touched the note with it, then put a corner into her mouth.
Some time ago, I saved the life of a man called Vodalus.
Agia pulled away from me, spewing crumbs.
Vodalus?
You're joking. Not at all. That's what his friend called him. I was still hardly more than a boy, but I held back the haft of an axe for a moment. The blow would have killed him, and he gave me a Chrysos.
Wait, what has this to do with Hildegrin?
When I first saw Vodalus, he had a man and a woman with him. Enemies came upon them, and Vodalus remained behind to fight, while the other man took the woman to safety. I had decided it was wiser to say nothing about the corpse or my killing of the Axemen. I'd have fought myself. Then there'd have been three fighters instead of one. Go on.
Hildegrin was the man with Votalus, that's all.
If we had met him first, I would have had some idea, or thought I had some idea, of why a Hipparch of the Septentrion Guard would want to fight me. And for that matter, why someone has chosen to send me some sort of furtive message. You know, all the things the Chatelaine Thecla and I used to laugh about, spies and intrigue, masked trysts, lost heirs. What's the matter, Agia?
Do I revolt you? Am I so ugly? You're beautiful. But you look as if you're about to be sick. I think you drank too fast. Here.
A quick twist took Agia out of her pavanine gown. It lay about her brown, dusty feet like a heap of precious stones. I had seen her naked in the Cathedral of the Pelerines, but now, whether because of the wine I had drunk, or the wine she had drunk, because the light was dimmer now, or brighter, or only because she had been frightened and shamed then, covering her breasts and hiding her womanhood between her thighs, she drew me far more. I felt stupid with desire, thick-headed and thick-tongued as I pressed her warmth against my own cold flesh.
Severian, wait. I'm not a strumpet, whatever you may think. But there's a price.
What?
You must promise me you won't read that note. Throw it into the brazier.
I let go of her and stepped back. Tears appeared in her eyes, rising as springs do among rocks.
I wish you could see the way you're looking at me now, Severian. No, I don't know what it says. It's just that. Have you never heard of some women having supernatural knowledge, premonitions, knowing things they could not possibly have learned?
The longing I had felt was nearly gone. I was frightened as well as angry, though I did not know why. I said, "We have a guild of such women, our sisters, in the Citadel. Neither their faces nor their bodies are like yours."
"I know I'm not like that. But that's why you must do what I advise. I've never in my life had a premonition of any strength, and I have one now. Don't you see, that must mean it's something so true and so important to you that you can't and mustn't ignore it. Burn the note!"
"Someone is trying to warn me, and you don't want me to see it. I asked you if the Septentrion was your lover. You told me he was not, and I believed you." She started to speak, but I silenced her.
"I believe you still.
Your voice had truth in it. Yet you are laboring to betray me in some way. Tell me now that it isn't so. Tell me you are acting in my best interests and nothing beyond."
"Severian."
"Tell me."
"Severian, we met this morning. I hardly knew you and you hardly know me. What can you expect? And what would you expect if you had not just left the shelter of your guild? I've tried to help you from time to time. I'm trying to help you now.
Put on your dress." I took the note from under the tray. She rushed at me, but it was not difficult to hold her off with one hand. The note had been penned with a crow quill, in a straggling scrawl. In the dim light, I could decipher only a few words.
"I could have distracted you and thrown it into the fire. That's what I ought to have done, Severian. Let me go!"
"Be quiet. I had a knife only last week. A Mazara cord with an ivy root handle. We were hungry, and Agilis put it in pawn. If I had it still, I could stab you now." "It would be in your gown, and your gown is over there on the floor." I gave her a push that sent her staggering backward. There was wine enough in her stomach,
that I was not entirely from the violence of my motion, into the canvas chair, and carried the note to a spot where the last light of the sun penetrated the crowding leaves. The woman with you has been here before. Do not trust her. Trudeau says the man is a torturer. You are my mother. Come again. Chapter 26 Senate. I had just had time to absorb the words when Agia jumped from her chair, snatched the note from my hand, and threw it over the edge of the platform. For a moment she stood before me, looking from my face to Terminus Est, which by this time leaned, reassembled, against an arm of the couch. I think she feared I was going to strike off her head and throw it after the note. When I did nothing, she said, "Did you read it?"
"Severian, say you didn't."
"I read it, but I don't understand it."
"Then don't think about it."
"Be calm for a moment. It wasn't even meant for me. It may have been for you, but if it was, why was it put where no one but I could see it? Agia, have you had a child? How old are you?"
23.
"That's plenty old enough, but no, I haven't."
"I'll let you look at my belly if you don't believe me."
I tried to make a mental calculation and discovered I did not know enough about the maturation of women. "When did you menstruate first?"
13.
"If I'd got pregnant, I would have been 14 when the baby came. Is that what you're trying to find out?"
"Yes. And the child would be 9 now. If it were bright, it might be able to write a note like that."
"Do you want me to tell you what it said?"
"No."
"How old would you say Dorcas is? 18? 19, perhaps?"
"You shouldn't think about it, Severian, whatever it was.
I won't play games with you now. You're a woman. How old?" Agia pursed her full lips.
"I'd say your drab little mystery's 16 or 17. Hardly more than a child."
Sometimes, as I suppose everyone has noticed, talking of absent persons seems to summon them up like eidolons. So it was now. A panel of the screen swung back and Dorcas came out. No longer the muddy creature we had become accustomed to, but a round-breasted, slender girl of singular grace. I have seen skin whiter than hers, but that was not a healthy whiteness. Dorcas seemed to glow. Freed of filth, her hair was pale gold. Her eyes were as they had always been, the deep blue of the world river Ouroboros in my dream. When she saw that Agia was naked, she tried to return to the shelter of the screen, but the thick body of the scullion prevented her. Agia said,
"I had better put my rags on again before your pet faints."
Dorcas murmured,
"I won't look."
"I don't care if you do,"
Agia told her. But I noticed she turned her back to us while she put on her gown. Speaking to the wall of leaves, she added,
"Now we really must go, Severian. The trumpet will sound at any moment."
"And what will that mean?"
"You don't know?"
She swung about to face us.
"When the machinations of the city wall appear to touch the edge of the solar disk, a trumpet, the first, is sounded on the sanguinary field. Some think it's only to regulate the combats there, though that's not so. It is a signal to the guards inside the wall to close the gates. It's also the signal to begin the fighting. And if you're there when it blows, that's when your contest will start. When the sun is below the horizon and true night comes, a trumpeter on the wall sounds tattoo.
That means the gates will not be opened again, even for those who carry special passes, and also that anyone who, having given or received a challenge, has not yet come to the